the Vipassana, a tradition, is something that we can honor as a reflection of how free our human process actually is. How free we are to recognize the freedom and to utilize that which is unbinding. There is no greater potential in existence than to fall in love with the potential for us to unbind ourselves from suffering. And there has to already be freedom within one's perception in order to even hear this, hear these teachings. Hear them in a way that leads to practical application. One of the things that the Kalama Sutta points out, and I apologize for those who weren't here and won't know exactly, you know, every detail of what I'm talking about, but, you know, I'm going to kind of build a little synopsis here. One of the aspects in the subtlety of the experience of these villagers, which I say we are the villagers in our inquiry with the Buddha or the Buddha's teachings, one of the recognitions in this is that this is, according to the translation by Soma Thera, the doctrine of free inquiry. That we're really developing these conditions, causes and effects that mature our consciousness so that we're able to recognize cause and effect. Oh, so simple. What does that mean? Oh, we're able to recognize the causes that give rise to that which is unwholesome, that which is binding, that which holds our perceptual process in what we might call delusion or confusion. Confusion, is that a word everybody recognizes? Where there really isn't a sense of what's going on. That comes about in a way that's clarified through direct experience. As well, this maturing consciousness is able to recognize as the wholesome causes that give rise to a more expanded, receptive, direct perception of what's occurring. And when we hear these words at first, they're bound in association. We effectively can only hear them at first and to some degree along the way in association with what we might have in our memory. Whereas direct experience frees us from memory. Frees us from the limited associations that we have built up in the perceptual process that arises with birth, this organism, and all and everyone without exception is born with certain influences that in the Sanskrit or Hindu tradition, in the Sanskrit term, samskaras or perceptions that are already at play owing to conditioning. And first of all, we can acknowledge that the conditioning is precognitive. It's elemental. You know, as elemental beings, we basically experience cold and heat and, you know, just the basics of the elemental experience of the body, this body, as well mirroring all phenomena. That sameness of elemental construction. And so we're born, and we're born in a kind of harmony, so to speak, with the universe. We're born into the Dhamma. We're born into that which basically governs the mind and body and the universe around. We're born into this, but we are born into a perception of separateness because of our conditioning that builds up and the perceptions that are already conditioned in the samskaric impressions of the brain associated with pleasant, unpleasant, and neutral. So naturally, at first, unpleasant is associated primarily with hunger. And I can't say that, you know, for each and every organism, because we all have an invisible inner process that's occurring at this elemental level, where that can only be perceived as pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral in a way that we've kind of left behind because we can't put it into a cognitive framework. So we spend time saying, why do I not feel good? Why this? Why that? Why, you know, why? And should. Have you noticed those inclinations? You know, we have difficulty to say, don't know. We want to put it into a construct. And within these constructs that are built of association, then the sense of self kind of manages it, you know. I think of the sense of self as a little central intelligence, you know, office, where, you know, it sits there feeling like it can control everything, and it's sort of like the Wizard of Oz. If you ever saw that, I think that was so poignant, if you ever saw that movie, poignant for us as children, perhaps, that at the end it was just a little person sitting there, you know, behind a veil, to no avail. And so in this doctrine of free inquiry that I'm going to bring into focus in our practice, it's really pointed out that we might be over-relying upon the buildup of associations that we've gathered, we've collected. You know, like going to the seashore and collecting seashells. You know, and we've collected. And then we try to, within this collection of associations, find the way. And the beauty of this process, as we begin to work with it rather than against it, work with change rather than against change, is that there is a clarity in active form clarification and a result purification. Sounds sort of moralistic. That occurs when that which knows the distinction between wholesome and unwholesome begins to be the operative of discernment. And therefore we are able to free our attention from it being so deeply embedded in confusion and associations that hold us in, well, I want to say an ancient collection of beliefs about the self, not just present time, because each being born has a storehouse as well. I refer to it when I'm speaking directly about the storehouse as that which haunts us. You know, I think of it as haunted houses. It's like what the Buddha said about, you know, the inquiry into what built this house, you know? It's like, well, this is a haunted house. Can you sense that? It's like every day is Halloween. And we're all wearing our Halloween costumes, you know, in our archetypal play of our mind in terms of what we shouldn't be and what we should be. We have two costumes. Well, maybe we have a vast wardrobe in the should-be department, whereas maybe we just have one sort of scaly, you know, costume in the shouldn't-be references. And I say scaly, I guess. I guess that's the word or reference that came out, because it really is so primitive. It goes all the way down to the swamp. I know when I feel swampy. You know, my practice has allowed me, or supported, not allowed, supported that recognition of kind of the, you know, swampy consciousness. You know, I one time saw, I still don't know if it was an alligator or a crocodile, but one is smaller, one is larger, something about, and how it was in some tropical zoo, maybe. And I was so drawn to just stop. First of all, the water. I'm always drawn to stop and look at what's reflected in water as a kind of metaphor, you know, for reflective awareness. And the conditions are constantly projecting different images. And there are this long, weird creature is, you know, and just kind of like, you know, eyes half underwater, half up. I tried that, by the way, in swimming. You can do it. It's just kind of like, just cold on, like that. So I was looking at the consciousness, thinking, oh wow. And just feeling that cold stillness that was in a timeless process of waiting for a warm body. Oh! Phew! Just like craving. Comes out of a coldness in the swamp. Lurks. And then, like that. And to be able to see all of the nature within this process. Primitive and exquisite. Born of the same conditions, but in a consciousness that allows for a natural reflective awareness, knowing of the distinction between that which is binding and that which is freeing. The crocodile alligator person doesn't care about this at all. Not the slightest, you know. Just as just waiting for a warm body to digest in order to wait for another warm body, and then somewhere along the way there's an urge to mate. Ah. But, you know, it isn't looking for its soulmate to go and buy a futon with. It's just flat out caught in impulse. And one of the things I really enjoy about my practice, I want to say that it's delightful, is just becoming familiar of that which is lurking, waiting. Waiting, huh? How much waiting? Waiting consciousness is there. What is this waiting for? Nothing. But it's residual. Waiting. Okay, I'm going to make up what I'm waiting for. Because in separation, without awareness, I'm just waiting. And then I make up what I'm waiting for. And then that isn't what I'm waiting for, so I get rid of that. And then, you know. So it's just a delightful process to begin to recognize, you know, what's really going on. And using this freedom, this potential for what's referred to as inquiry, to choose, and this is the, I want to say, highest possibility in life in terms of action. To choose what one wishes, intends to cultivate. And within the Vipassana tradition, we have a word that's kind of hidden in the confusion of presentation oftentimes. And I'm so fortunate to have lived in the IMS kind of culture as it began to burgeon through all of its developmental stages, although I'm not living out there anymore, but to really be there, you know, with, you know, our friends that came back and we're kind of putting this together, and then Upandita that came along and said, now, wait a minute. You know, and then all the evolutions with metta coming into the culture and blah, blah, blah. And the thing that is hidden in the kind of misnomers as we're seeing it now that have come about, like insight meditation, is this term bhavana, which is really the term for meditation. Meditation being that process where the clarity of this freedom arises in the recognition that it's all an intentional potential aligned with intention and attention. And the clarity, the intention, the maturing intention, and therefore the galvanizing of the force of attention with what one chooses to cultivate. And it can be as simple as, oh, cultivating the awareness of a sensation, as opposed to, like I like to say in one inquiry, I met somebody that thought that that intention sort of aligned with becoming a Buddha was, you know, what made the most sense in this life. And I just said, wow. Okay. Meanwhile, you know, here intention is humble. Humble in its receptivity, it becomes less greedy. This is not a judgment of this person whose intention is to become a Buddha in this life, but it's very greedy. I mean, what is Buddha? What is anything? Until there's direct experience. Direct experience becomes the basis for our recognition of the Dhamma, as well how we even hear it when it's presented. Direct experience. And so direct, so immediate, so humble, that it becomes extricated from the wanting, because it's what already is. It already is. The breathing is already here. Initially, our intention starts out there. You know, I want to become the projection of what? On and on and on and on. You know about all this. You've seen it. And then as the practice matures, it's the intention comes closer and closer and closer and closer and closer to enoughness right here, right here. It's enough to be with sensation within breathing. There's a beautiful declaration, exclamation, a proclamation, I'm not quite sure, somewhere in those words in the Anapanasati Sutta, where the Buddha says, right almost in the beginning, I am content within this practice of awareness of inhalation and exhalation. He says, I am content. And I trust this translation because is Tana Asaro Bhikkhu's translation, and have checked it out with Bhikkhu Bodhi. You know, because translations are a little bit different. I am content. The Buddha says, I am content in this practice of awareness of inhalation and exhalation. My heart is content. And so he says, whether it's the assembly, the villagers that we are, you know, what is it that allows for us to practice, that brings about this sense of And contentment in the Buddhist sense is a sense of balance and ease. That there is a faith that within the wisdom in choosing our practice, that we have chosen a practice that is worthy of our efforts, which is a line, a quote from My Perfect Master, the first line, that we choose a practice worthy of our efforts. How happy is this when this alignment occurs? I am at home. I am at home. And then we actually do enter into this haunted house and open the doors and windows and everything and allow the elemental process to unfold by approximating, as faith grows, approximating the possibility that it's enough to be with that which is. And within this, experience this contentment, this sense of being at home within a process of maturing consciousness, where we become the guardians of the Dhamma, because we know that this is what this is, our human beingness. An all-inclusive appreciation. You know, the crocodile alligator, will I ever know, was an experience of Dhamma. Because I could feel that consciousness. Feel that consciousness. I was having an ice cream cone with a friend of mine, with Song Sinim, who's a scholar out at BCBS, a Zen master actually. And we were licking our ice cream cones and looking at the cow who made the milk. And he simply said, I wonder what cow consciousness is like. And then we laughed, because in our training with our Dhamma father, Zen Master Tsungsa, before I found my home in Vipassana, there was this kind of koan thing, and you would say moo. You know, you were enlightened if you said moo, you know. Empty. Moo means empty. So people would go, moo. So I said, moo. And he looked at me, and that's what's called Zen combat, you know. It's kind of fun if you know how to play it, but if you don't want to try playing it with somebody who doesn't know what it is. And it was just empty. I don't know. If we were to wake up every day with the commitment to register this truth within our awareness, first of all, don't know. And then spend a few moments just sort of in the registry of the sensory experience of the body, you know, just sweeping up, sweeping down, experiencing sensation, settling into breathing, within a few minutes, a state of awe would arise. Because it's incomprehensible. And then from this conducive experience of awe, receive our experience of life as it flows into our six sense doors. Registering when distraction goes to why and should and grasping and da-da-da, which is a part of the sensibility that comes with practice, just this knowing, and return to don't know, sensation, breathing, then throughout the day there would be this building of this sense of contentment in the heart. Not because we've accomplished anything, but because we have embraced a new set of conditions that just come out of the actuality of the truth. And then open up the experience for what's called investigation. And investigation related to our practice today will be guided by and supported by the quality of Kanti, or patience, and I'll explain. When the Buddha was listening very, very carefully to the villagers, and in order to hear what their cries for help were about, their concerns. You know, their concerns were specific, but at a deeper level, in compassion, we know as Karuna and Kuan Yin, representing listening to the cries. He heard the cries of their confusion that were in a conceptual process of trying to figure out the truth, how to know the truth, how to experience that, as opposed to this confusion of different conveyances, as well aspects of nature and character within people conveying their version of the Dhamma as they came through the village. We can identify with that. And so the Buddha just says, well, maybe we're relying too much on concepts. Maybe they're taking the form. That's pretty. Is that me? I don't think so. Well, it's pretty anyway. So, you know, form. Maybe we're looking towards form, books. Maybe today we're going to sit here and when restlessness arises, we're going to think about the book that we read. The Buddha also says maybe we're relying too much upon our own experience and how we have interpreted. Maybe we're relying too much upon speculation, comparison. Oh boy. Right? Comparison, that which we remember with now. Maybe we're relying too much upon the view of someone else, and this is particularly highlighted, one's teacher. In Vipassana, we don't have such a hierarchy as in some traditions. Teacher is a good fortune if one has one, if there's the affinity and the process that sets up, you know, where there's no attachment within the relationship, but just a mirroring of this process. But it's not required. It's not like a requirement, as we hear in other traditions. It's just a good fortune. But maybe we're leaning in, really trying to match up with somebody else's experience. You know. So today can be not so much about matching up with these particular categories that we might be over-relying upon, but just remembering that our practice is a process of returning and entering into what is here. And in the first part of today, becoming familiar, because this is what we can do in this life, is just to become familiar with the direct experience that's occurring here through sensation, which also includes the differentiation between sensation and thought and thinking. See if we can build up and the reallocation of energy, which is consciousness, here, with the patience and tolerance that allows for the humility that we experience when we realize that this is not the natural inclination of the restlessness that exists existentially, that wants to grasp at something, wants to think. Let's become familiar with the distinction between the steadiness of intentional receptivity within the process of the awareness with breathing and that natural impulsive. We have more refined impulses than the crocodile or the alligator, but the roots is the same. Wanting, not wanting. Investigation occurs when one chooses bhavana, cultivation, and experiences the humility of the falling away of that sense of the need to serve the self as central intelligence, where we build up this quality called Kanti, that's translated as patience, which is then tolerance, perseverance, and resolve. Soft resolve, not willful. Just this is the sensation within the inhalation that is the beginning. This is a sensation that carries through middle, sensory process. Oh, end, pause, arising. It's all happening on its own, right? Do you recognize what I'm referring to here? Anybody not? Yeah, because it's natural. We recognize it. So today is going to be just about continued familiarity. I think clarification on the Buddha's teachings from a very human point of view, reflecting our humanity as it is helpful. Rather, in the conveyance that puts it into some kind of esoteric, far-fetched, conceptual, ideological view. Here we open up to investigation because something knows the distinction between these sensations unfolding within the inhalation and exhalation, within the sitting process, and the attentional departure into conceptualization. May not know immediately, but when the knowing knows, that's the moment of anatta. That's the moment of emptiness. The knowing knows the distinction. The moment of recollection, intention, cultivation. So beautiful. Not easy, but so beautiful and so simple. Perhaps it would be good to just have a little stretch in a moment before we then enter into our own experience today, because we're bringing a great deal of our own experience already and going to be sorting it out inadvertently. And I honor that. These are just suggestions. But before we stretch, do you have any questions that would help you to feel more settled in, more present here, more aligned with your intention to practice today? Any impulse, you know, that carries off into proliferation, Papanja, is some form of wanting. Yeah, so simpler though, I just made the kind of little note that the knowing, the arising of the knowing in the proliferation is a moment of emptiness that then allows for one to remember intention. We don't look for the emptiness, we can't see it. It's an insight. It's a momentary just clarification. So I use that word. Maybe it was not skillful, because for anybody to be looking for insight, here just that familiarity of that which knows the difference that allows for returning. Yeah, like that. You got it. Yeah, and I apologize if there's anything I said that made it more complicated than that. I was just adding a little bit of a technical, you know, dash of information in there. Yeah. Yeah. There's no content in the process within breathing. No content. There's content in thinking, there's context and so forth, but that's what you can know the distinction between. And I'm not going to give it any technical references, because then you'll think them. You love to think. And that's natural. So, simply consider using the time wisely today within the rounding to identify sensation, and how, I want to say, how little tolerance there is. I'm saying for all of us, you know, just in the awareness of with sensation, with receiving sensation, and that need and want and want and want and want and want to understand that we have to varying degrees, and that keep this from being something that can really work for us. Thinking, I mean, you know, it's helpful. It has its role. It's syllogistic. It's 1 and 1 equals 2. It's weighing, it's measuring. You know, like that. But, you know, only if you're planning a trip or, you know, like things like that, practical things. So that question is empty in the sense that it will only keep the energies of consciousness spinning and spinning and hitting dead ends and whatever. Right? We've known each other for a little bit, so if that felt too direct, it's because I was trained in Zen before. Vipassana, whack. I want you to know that. I go, boop. I hope it doesn't hurt. But if it does, it's dukkha. I hope you don't bleed. That's what I meant. Yes. Oh, no, you can't experience breath. Sensations, breathing, that's what you... See, this is very confusing, this conveyance. Be aware of breath. You can't be aware of breath. You can be aware of breathing. Sensations. Yeah, the process, the mechanism. We can be aware of the sensations. We can't, you know, it's like, I can't go like this, like an apple off a tree and say, oh, okay, and then follow it through. And then, oh, you know, like this. Right? It's much clearer than that. Yes. Consider before don't know, just knowing, noting, thinking, and then don't know. If it feels like the thinking is going, but, think me more, you know. It's just impulse. It's just momentum of the habit. So sometimes just thinking, which is what we hear in Vipassana, just noting efficiently, and then maybe if it just don't know is a kind of training into that which is known directly. Does that make sense? Yeah, we're playing with this. Okay? Yes. Yeah. Any mind moment in which the conditions of knowing are actively engaged in that manner, that is a moment of purification. Because it's extricating I think the only thing that we can ever know about mind, which we can't really know, but we have heard, is that it's a vast field of energy, and attention is like the hose, you know, we're watering whatever, you know, so we're like that. The reason that we have such a challenge in practice is that there's more momentum and thinking, and it rips, whoosh, from here to Keokuk, Iowa, and, you know, that person we saw on the street, we don't know their name, but maybe that's where they live, and, you know, don't they have, you know, wonderful trains there or something that we've heard about? Like that, you know? And then suddenly, like you said, the knowing, the Budo in the Thai forest tradition, or the objective awareness arises, and thinking, oh, returning. That moment, that sati, objective awareness, and opaque arise, oh, you know, is the very nature of wisdom, the knowing of the distinction. And so then the freedom is there. Mm-hmm. And that is a moment of purification because you have broken the chain of reaction of that impulse and that papanja and brought the hose back to what you're intending to cultivate. If we can choose cultivation without having to know a lot about it, we can't, you know about the mechanisms of breathing. It's just a part of the autonomic nervous system. You know, so it's hard sometimes. It's like, I don't know what this means to be sitting here breathing. Right? You know, so, you know, it's a process that builds up within its own momentum, so the thinking kind of drain on it is not so likely to occur. That's likely to kind of fall away a little bit as that hose of application kind of builds up some momentum, energy. Yeah. We'll still remain haunted. You know. No, nothing ends. It's our relationship with it changes. It's still floating around in the... That's my definition of mind. I thought I should explain. Okay. So here we are. We are so fortunate. I'm so happy to be with you.